For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. I'm very happy to have as our guest speaker tonight Shoto Spring. Shoto trained at Green Gulch and Tassajara and the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, and was ordained and authorized as a teacher by Shohaku Okamura, my translation collaborator and old friend. And Shoto is extraordinary as an American Zen teacher in being someone who walks the walk in many ways and applies the Dharma to the situations of our world and is very active in expressing that in terms of what's going on in the world. And so many of you have heard me talk about the situation of our environment and the climate, and particularly the Keystone Tar Sands Pipeline, and Shoto's about to embark on a walk about that. And so, Shoto, thank you for being here to talk about your work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll introduce with a little bit of a story. So last night I got on a Greyhound in Minneapolis and rode all night and arrived in Chicago and went to visit a friend who said, "Wow," about riding the Greyhound. I notice many people say that. It's customary to take an airplane. It's not unusual to take an airplane somewhere maybe every month or something. And it's unusual to travel by bus or to refuse to take an airplane. When I was growing up, it was unusual to go someplace by airplane, and it was more usual to take the train or not to go. The world has changed a great deal since I was a child. And so I noticed some things, and this is just like a context, some things that we think are necessary. Some things that the average American, and probably including most Zen students, think would be really hard to get along without. And I'll make a really short list. Central heating. Cars. Grocery stores. Fast food. Things that are cheap to buy. Modern medicine. To be able to go to a store and buy new clothes and new shoes that were made by somebody else somewhere that don't cost, say, a month's wages. And then, of course, we have television and movies and cell phones and the internet. And being able to get things instantly. I notice now that if I turn off my cell phone, say, for a day, that people will feel it. And I'm going to be, it'll be about two full days that I haven't been able to answer my email. And I forgot to put an auto reply on it. And so that lack of instant response, people are going to notice. So there are a lot of things. Oh, air conditioning. You know, I also grew up where air conditioning was quite rare. Libraries and grocery stores. And a very few other places. And then there are the things that we assume that we can't have. We assume that we can't have safety on the street in the city. We assume that we can't allow children to spend hours outside in the city playing unsupervised. we assume that we can't have the kind of neighborly relationships in which naturally, if you have a problem, your neighbor will help you. We can't have nutritious food enough for everyone. We have to have bad food or toxic food and not enough for everyone. We can't have clean air and clean water. Lasting marriages, profound religious experiences, Zen is one of the few places that even suggests having such things. And most of us think that they're very, very rare. Education that liberates rather than narrowing. And then we have things like civil liberties. And now there's a question about the future. There's been a thing, certainly for my parents' generation and maybe this generation, that our children's lives will be better than our own. We have expected that, and the generation that's coming of age is the generation in which this is being disappointed. And we meant materially better, most of us. And certainly my parents gave their children what they didn't have. I jumped ship, but my siblings all gave their kids what more than they had. But in this generation, we haven't given them better health. We've given them rather an epidemic of things like ADHD, behavior problems, neurological damage, autism. Horrendous stories about sexuality, harassment of girls, and things like that for children really much too young. Violence and shootings. Wilderness, boredom. Time to be bored out of your head. So those are the things that we're not having, but we sort of ignore that, or maybe we don't know it, but those things are going on. And then we look into the future and we say, well, food, safe food and water, enough for everyone. We are beginning to see floods, fires, hurricanes, droughts, deaths of all kind, including how many oil spills have there been, how many illnesses and deaths from fracking. They've been covering up nuclear power deaths for a long time by jiggling with the statistics. And then more around the world, but it's coming closer. Children and adults dying in wars as so-called collateral damage, or going to school by boat because the whole area is flooded, or just plain not having enough food to eat because of the droughts. So by hanging on to that first group of things, the one that has cars and central heating and so forth, we find somehow that we either have lost or are losing the second group, the one that involves good food, air, education, community. And then there's this third group. Hurricane Sandy came to New York. Well, oh, yeah, the series of tornadoes went to Oklahoma. Oh, what about here? What about when it comes here? Really scary. And at the same time, there are people who never did have the air conditioning in the cars, are losing the things that they had, for instance, living in the forests and having the songbirds be so loud that it's like a din in your ear. being able to hunt for your food and being able to gather medicines that can cure pretty much everything, and not having cancer, and not having kids have cancer, and so forth. And of course, I'm thinking particularly of stories that I heard when last August I went up to Canada. I was at the Tar Sands Healing Walk, and then I went to an action camp in British Columbia where they're getting ready. Well, they are now stopping pipelines. And the First Nations there and our Native people here, because they have some legal rights and because they're more connected to the land, are the leaders in the protection of this world that we have. So, and there's something about that. So as I was traveling, I think you know that I'm planning to lead a walk this summer. And what I was doing up there last August was traveling that route and meeting as many people as I could. And at one place on the Fort Peck Reservation, the activist that I spoke to wanted me to talk to her brother, who was a traditional medicine man. He asked me about Buddhism, and then whatever he said to her, I didn't hear, but then she went around telling people that I was leading this walk to bring back the old traditional ways. So when I, as a Buddhist, say, the reality is we're all connected, everything is interconnected, nobody is alone, nobody is separate from creation, there's an echo right there, or we're echoing them. It's like, for some reason, Buddhism has reached back and recognized that thing that everybody used to know and now hardly anybody knows. So I recognize a kinship there in our basic assumptions about the world, that they or those of them who practice their traditional ways know and remember that this world is our home. They know that humans are not somehow masters of everything. And Mel, in talking about the defense of their land in British Columbia, there was one man who would say, it's not that we have a right to this land, it's that we have a responsibility to it. We have to take care of it. So that rang truer to me than anything that anybody else has said. We live on this earth. This earth has been taking care of us since the human species was born. This earth has been taking care of us even while we have exploited, mined for minerals, discovered oil, multiplied beyond the carrying capacity, because fossil fuels allowed us to do that. And only now are there any things that might even look like the earth not taking care of us. You know, some people say, starting to fight back. And, you know, that's not what I'm saying, but it's like one could read the signs that way, because the planet's a little less safe than it was, and it's looking like it's going to get worse. And I stopped talking to my grandchildren about it because it freaks them out. They don't want to hear it. And it's not their job. So that's my introductory story. It's a little extensive. So I'd like to bring forth an issue involving practice, not only for Buddhists, but anyway, here is this issue. do we engage with the world around us as creators and co-creators of that world, or do we do personal solutions? Now, when I put it that way, you can guess what I think the answer is. But there is a tradition, and particularly in Zen, called accepting what is offered. Gratefully accepting whatever is offered. Reb Anderson said this very funny thing once. He said, sometimes the support of all sentient beings looks more like the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And so the strong, this is very, very important in personal practice to accept what is offered. If you get into monastic practice, one of the ways that the monastic training is good for you is that whenever you don't want to do what they tell you to, you have to do it anyway, and you get to see all the I want, I want, I want that comes up. And I want really comes up a lot. You know, I got a whole string of things that I want. And so we have to have that. We have to have accept what is offered. And yet, there is a place of, let's say, discernment where we also, what's going on also includes the fact that we are creators. I think what many Buddhists do, and some don't, but it seems like the majority says, accept what's there without saying, and accept that you are a creator. And so I'm proposing that part of what we accept is our own role in creating the universe of the future. Not in a new agey kind of way. You know, on the personal level, the only thing we own is our actions. And in fact, we create ourselves by our actions. And so there have been people who made radical changes from a life that was, you know, about drugs or crime or like total selfishness into a life that was about care for other people and things like that. And the way you make that change is not just by thinking something. There will be an inspiration and then you start taking actions. And every action you take goes, you know, takes you in the direction that you're acting. So okay. So here's a personal thing. See, I spent a long time wanting to be a priest. And my first teacher died, and I was floating around for a while, and then I was studying with somebody who was very slow, and then finally I got ordained. But in that very early phase, I was going around asking all the local priests what it meant to be a priest. And the first one I asked said, "This comes first." And that was my favorite answer. It's still with me. This comes first. She didn't say what this is, you know? It's like, I learned later, sometimes it means, it's nice and sunny outside and you're going to be sitting inside learning chants. And someone is going to be outside taking out the trash, resenting your privilege for, you know? It's like, the priests get to do all the cool stuff. But anyway, it's like, this comes first. And when I was ordained, it took a few years to get a feeling for what it had meant. But I received transmission just last fall. And there's lots of ceremony stuff. And I had a feeling at the time about what that meant. You know, we'll see in 5 years what I think it meant. But I thought, means, oh, I have a job. I have now accepted a job assignment. My job assignment is to free all beings. Okay. And I don't know what I thought Dharma transmission was going to be about. You know, I knew some of the externals. But when I was actually in the process, I went, oh, this is a job. This is something to do. And that matches that this comes first thing.
So... Now...
This is a point where I have lots of notes, but they're not sequential, because I don't like to read my talks. Let me say, let me say something about what I'm doing and how that came to happen. I'll say how it came to happen first. So I have four grandchildren. The third one was born in 2005. He's eight now, and I went to visit him when he was about 5 months old, and he was a really, really laughing, happy baby. And it was wonderful to be with him. The only thing wrong was that a few months earlier I had gone to a talk by Richard Heinberg. How many people know who Richard Heinberg is? Not too many. He writes books about peak oil and peak coal. And generally he writes books about what's actually happening with our fossil fuel problems. And he persists, he's, you know... He writes, and he's an activist, and I had gone to that talk with a sort of vague feeling that we were in trouble. I came out of that talk with a really, really depressed feeling that we were in big, huge, enormous trouble. And I started to have, say, dreams of one of my children and her family being shot because people thought they had food. This was about peak oil, of course, right? You know, our food system is based on petroleum. Our food comes from 1,500 miles away on the average. We burn 10 calories of fossil fuel for every calorie of food we eat. Little things like that. And so I thought, okay, when it crashes, there will be widespread hunger. The grocery stores have 3 days' worth of food in them. And I thought, well, what happens? People go to where they think the food is and they do whatever they need to get it. And that's why it's like the daughter who is wealthy, she's really well off anyway. It's like people would figure they could get something there. So... And I was upset for a really long time. Well, maybe a year or so. Because then I took a permaculture design course. And I understood that we could reverse climate change. We could reverse, well, we could get along without fossil fuels. And we could reverse climate change. Because that was 7 years ago that I was thinking this. And so it was easier to say we can do this then than it is now. And so we went through the years, and I knew lots of things we should do. I even sent letters to Obama when he was elected. And I saw that we weren't doing them. You know, we elected the guy who said he was going to stop climate change, and things keep going on as usual. And people keep going on as usual, too. Like, everyday people are living... lives using more energy than we did 5 years ago, creating more carbon emissions, even though we can see that climate change is really happening. The permaculture design course clarified something for me about what was needed, because I knew that it wasn't new technology that we needed. I knew that what we needed was a change of heart and a spiritual change, and I went, aha, I'm now in the profession of spiritual change. So I was happy that I had gone and ordained, although I'd never quite known why I did it before. And still it was there. Okay, so how do you do this? So I've done a lot of things. I've participated in transition towns, which work on creating local resilience, local food, local everything, which not only protects people, but it also diminishes the causing of climate change. I've done low-level opposition to fossil fuels because in order to survive, we need both to stop the use of fossil fuels and to do a whole bunch of actions that would put, planting massive forests and some things like that, that would put carbon back into the ground. And a few people are doing them in small ways. And still, things are getting worse. So I didn't know what I would do when my training was finished. I thought I would get some land, grow food myself, because I believe that everybody needs to grow food, and get locally involved to try to, improve local ordinances so that they, and maybe state ordinances, so that they would be more friendly to the climate, or that at least they would create a little buffer for people. Instead of staying in a community where I was pretty happy, I moved back. I can't live by both of my children, but I can live by one of them. And that reduces the amount of travel I need. And to me, to have the kind of investment in travel that happens when you live a long distance from those you love, it's like you can never do the right thing. You will always, because you have to see your family members, or you have to see the people you love. So that's really high on my list. But I still didn't know what I was going to do. And I took a teaching position for a while, and then I went back to do my last two monastic training periods. Oh, in between there, I was finally available. I had no temple duties and no job, and I went and got arrested at the White House under the Keystone Pipeline. And there's some pictures of me around doing that. They asked us all to wear our robes, and then out of 100 religious people, there were 3 of us wearing our robes, including the person who put out the request. They do this little thing. Me and 2 Franciscan monks actually wore our robes. So anyway, things are funny. But So I'd been arrested, I'd done a little writing, and I came back, and I went to Tassajara. And they put me in the kitchen. And I think it was in my second week there, maybe my third week, I was sitting in the Zendo and I started seeing pictures. And I was seeing pictures of me walking along the pipeline. And I just kept seeing the pictures. They kept coming up. And so I started talking with practice leaders and talking with the teachers and talking with the people who were available to me there. It's interesting to me that I did not call my own teacher, because they have telephones there and I could have done that. And eventually I did talk to him. And he said, don't do it until you have your brown robe. But basically, he doesn't tell people what to do. And so, I was looking for people that would give me some of that kind of American advice. They all encouraged me, every last one of them. They even, pushed a little harder.
That's good to hear.
So by the time I left Tassajara, it's like that's from September to March, I knew I was going to do it. And then I could go on the internet again and learn practical details. And I had also had time to sort out what it was about. And right now, okay. So right now we're in the phase, we've produced a brochure. There's a group of people, most of whom are not Buddhists, I'm not sure how that happened, but I do, you know? It's like BPF was going to send somebody from San Francisco Zen Center. Oh, well, they needed him to be cook. Oh, this person agreed to be guest cook for the summer. Oh, this person needs to, you know? I mean, you're in there, and you agree to do what they ask you to do, and so you can't always do something that calls to you. Anyway, so we have, I mean, there'll be some Buddhists, but I don't know that they'll be coming from the monasteries. And saying what it is that we're about is always tricky. But earlier today I managed to do it, so let me see if I can do it again. The first thing it is a giant ceremony. It's a 3-month ceremony. And the ceremony includes sitting zazen morning and evening. It includes walking as walking meditation or walking as prayer. And it includes every interaction that we have with anybody along the way. And in that ceremony, someone asked me what kind of ceremony it was. I went, oh, okay. And then he listed off, you know, a bunch of kinds of ceremonies. So I'm saying it's a ceremony of gratitude and appreciation to the earth, the ceremony of giving something to the earth. And then he mentioned there were ceremonies of preventing disaster. And I'd say, yeah, I think it's a ceremony of preventing disaster, too. But really, it's about... And then the second part is offering the vision, and offering the vision that it's not necessary and it's not even happier to treat the world as a resource and to think that material things make us happy. This is not a Buddhist vision, but it is the overwhelming majority American vision, and it's what's constantly being beaten into our heads if we listen to any media at all. So it's that. It's actually clearly a lie that those things make us happy. There's been research on what makes people happy. Your first $10,000 make you happier. After that, it's a wash. really, that's one of the interesting tidbits. It's like, it actually matters in whether you have, you know, like basic necessities. And after that, happiness does not move with income. And the other thing is that happiness comes from giving. Let's see, and people with spiritual community, people with more connections are happier and less stressed and so forth. So it's offering this. It's offering an alternative to the American way of life, while the rest of the world tries to get into the American way of life. But it's like, we're here, so I can deal with one country or one continent. That's pretty big. So the thought is that while we're expressing this gratitude toward the earth and living in a way, we're also offering this picture. And it's the Buddhist picture, and it's the Native American picture. We're part of the family of life. It takes care of us. How about we just let it take care of us, and we take care of it back, and stop trying to fix things that weren't broken. We have some broken things to fix now, but how about if we just go back to that being part of the family of life thing? So that's the walk. Do I have anything else to say? Oh. And then there's this trick. This is a Zen trick about doing things with a goal. My teacher says, if you're sitting zazen to get enlightened, you're still doing business. So, if we do this walk for the purpose of changing everybody's mind, or for the purpose of a ceremony that somehow magically shifts things, we're still doing business, and then nothing will happen. So, nothing profound will happen. And so, It's quite a challenge. And I will say that since I accepted this, what feels to me like the universe asked me to do this, it doesn't feel like I came up with it. It feels like I was asked to do it and I didn't step away. I've slept better. I don't feel guilty and anxious. I feel worried. I feel lots of things. But there's deciding to be wholehearted instead of negotiating, deciding that this is the best thing I have to offer on this subject called climate change, and deciding that I would actually offer the best I have has been an incredible relief. And I have no idea what, you know, where it's going to take me. And that's, that relief is like, it's a subjective psychological thing, I guess, but those of you who have wholeheartedly taken up practice probably have some idea of what the relief I'm talking about. You know, you stop negotiating and just go, okay, I'll go along. Any questions?
I just want to say again what I said to you before, that you are doing this for so many of us.
Yeah, I have not started a group in my hometown. I'm hoping that I'll get to do that after I come back.
So, comments, questions, responses, for sure, please.
What is action about?
Sure. So what we're going to do, first, well, we're going up into Alberta. We will spend a couple of days in retreat. We will go to the tar sands themselves, which are a little north of Fort McMurray, which is way north of Edmonton, and we'll walk with the fourth annual healing walk. So that's what we're doing first. And then we'll drive down to Hardisty, which
that's
is the...
That's the Native People's Walk, or what is the
that's,
fourth?
Yeah, that's they're called the Keepers of the Athabaskan, and they're either all or almost all Indigenous. And Hardisty is a place where pipelines have been since the 1950s, and it is the place where the new construction on this pipeline would start. And so we will go there, and that's where we'll actually start walking. And so we come down through Alberta, we cut the southwestern corner of Saskatchewan, the northeastern corner of Montana, and then a little more, the southwestern corner of South Dakota, and then kind of through the east and middle, going to Steel City, Nebraska. So it's like, it's somewhat diagonal. And Steel City is where it's supposed to join the existing Keystone Pipeline.
And how many people are coming?
Everybody wants, I wish I knew that. I've been saying 10 because I think we'll probably have 10 most of the time, unless really a lot of people join us along the way, which might happen. A lot of people, you know, are going to come for a week or you know, a short period of time. Yeah. But there's a core group of at least 5. It, you know, people keep joining. And then sometimes they back out. So a core group of 5 to 10 that will do the whole thing. I'm aware that I might be a little intense. And so it might be hard to ask a question. Please ask anyway. Yeah.
Are you anticipating any resistance? Have the people in the healing walk face resistance?
The people in the healing walk... So I was there last year. I did not see any trouble. It was a peaceful walk. You know, there's a lot of people out there doing civil disobedience and getting blockading and things like that. And they always get trouble. And now they're getting trained to treat the local police and sheriffs are getting trained to treat demonstrators as terrorists, and TransCanada is helping them with this training. These trainings, apparently they have people's photographs and stuff. So, I don't know if they would dare to send anybody new to Guantanamo, but there are a lot of bad things you can do. I don't know if they're still doing extraordinary rendition either. But, I mean, for instance, Tim DeChristopher, do people who know who that is?
Some people here know.
Okay. So he stopped an illegal land sale, and for that he got to spend 2 years in prison. And he wasn't allowed to raise any of the important issues in his defense in the court case. So it's going like that. People are spending long times in prison. And other people are being targeted and assassinated and stuff like that. So,
You said a little bit about how this walk came about for you. Mm-hmm. Could you just maybe say a few words about the four or five people who were going to be joining you? You said they weren't necessarily coming to the Buddhists.
Right, yeah.
So who are they?
Okay, let me see. Well, John was somebody I met at a Never Mind. Well, it's a conference called World Work, which is an interesting thing of itself. But his wife is Native American, had done the longest walk in 2008. And first, I sought consultation, and then it became clear to him that he was going to come on it. And he had to put aside a lot of things because he is active in various ways. So, what can I say about it? He says he's coming to witness. Laura says that she was just cruising around the web, and she says, I've been waiting for something like this. Davey said, first he got that he should lend us the school bus. He has a Veggie Isle school bus. They spent 3 years crossing America picking up trash. First he knew that he should give the school bus, and then he said it became clear to him that he needed to go. And let's see, Jessica's like that, and Mark, it's like we have people who have miscellaneous kinds of spirituality, and some of them have spirit guides to talk to them, and some of them just wait until they, you know, have a feeling about what they need to do. I talked to one recently, and it's interesting because she's personal friends with somebody who's doing a different kind of walk. And he said, so why are you going on this one and not that one? And she says, because that's what Spirit told me to do. It's like that. So we're getting that kind of thing. Oh, Rosalie Little Thunder had a vision that she should walk on the pipeline. Looks like she'll be with us for a couple of weeks. And she's allowing us to make capital out of the fact that we're having Native American walking with us. It's like, she knows what's going on. It's okay.
How long do you expect the entire walk to take?
About 3 months. We've allotted, it's like, since we're starting with a week of not walking, instead of going to July to September, we're now going into October. And I sort of want it to be like a practice period, so I want it to be 3 months. I also, my daughter and my grandchildren want it not to be too long. But I've allowed the possibility that it might be, you know, not totally in our control.
What do your daughters and your grandchildren think about it? Do your grandchildren, do they understand like what's going on? I don't know how old they are, but they know what's going on.
Well, let me see. Well, they all know I'm going on this walk. The ones who are close to me, the kids are 12 and 9 now. And the 12-year-old recently said to me that she didn't believe in global warming. Now, it was it April or May, and it was snowing. and I don't remember what triggered it, But I thought, okay, she's 12-year-old. She needs not to think about it. I mean, my first response was to say, well, you'll find out then. But actually, I made a decision to leave. It's just too traumatic to think. I mean, she wants to have a normal adolescence. She wants to go to college. She wants to get a regular job. She wants all that stuff. And for me to say, you can't have that. You know, there's one of the walkers who has, he decided to take up a support role, and he's been doing all the calling and the route planning and finding his places to stay. He's 22, and he says he thinks he's not going to go back to college because there's too much work to do now. And that's, it's like, ooh, you know? It's like, I wouldn't want to be young at this time and knowing that.
So then you're walking, or do they know your grandchildren? They just know that you're just going?
They know I'm going on a walk, and what else? I think they know it has something to do with climate change, and I don't know what all they know. It's like they've seen them, the brochures, various versions of them.
Are your dogs supportive?
Well, the daughter in that family got very upset at me because I keep promising to come home and wasn't. This was last year. And I said, and I thought it would be 6 months, and I thought we'd walk the whole pipeline. And I said, okay, I'll come home first. And then I'll do 3 months instead of 6 months. Is that better? But now she's like, you know, she's with me. You know, I had to say goodbye to all of them, and she called me, and we talked for a while. And so it's like, I mean, she does know why I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. And I've stopped trying to convince her that things are terrible. And I'm letting her raise the kids. Mm-hmm. And I'm retired, and I'm doing this. My other daughter, it isn't so personal. She's farther away, and our plan, which is a plan because of use of fossil fuels, is that I spend a month with them every year rather than flying back and forth. So we had the month, and we talk. I think I use her professional skills in some way or other. But anyway. But that family, I don't know. And that's tricky, too, because I said to her, you know, the reason I'm not moving to Atlanta is because I think you're going to have to leave Atlanta. Ouch, you know. This is like, and I don't say that to the kids. But her kids are learning environmental stuff in school. Probably not climate change, but, you know, they're learning some things.
So I know that there are people here who work on related issues, and I don't know if anybody else has some things to just to say,
yeah,
to Shoto, or just general comments. Hello?
About 100 questions, but one is, what can we do to help you?
Yes. Let me see. I've come to a certain sequence. So the first thing you can do is sit with us. And I was saying 6 a.m. and 8 p.m. Actually, those will be the times, you know.
Which time zone?
Yeah.
Well, whatever time zone we're in.
Okay.
But if you did central time zone, that would be close enough.
Okay.
You would never be more than 1 hour off. I think most of the time we'll be in mountain time. And pray for us. Put our name, if you do names on the altar, you know.
We'll put you in the well-being list.
Exactly, yeah.
So should we just say the what's it called?
Compassionate Earth Walk.
Compassionate Earth Walk. We'll add to the well-being list, okay.
Yes, right. Okay, let's see. And then there is, take a brochure, tell your friends, tell everyone. I mean, of course, first thing is, if you're free, come and walk with us. But the people, you know, at this point, there aren't so many people who can clear that space. So I skipped that one. We can use money. Yeah, money's good. Well, money's not good, but in this society, it's kind of necessary.
Well, okay, I'll make the pitch now.
Okay.
We need help to support, Ancient Dragon needs help to support guest teachers coming, and we have a bunch of others who will be coming in the next month or so, but particularly tonight to help Shoto and to help the Compassionate Earth Walk. So.
Yeah, thanks.
There's a donation bowl outside in the front.
Yeah, it'll go to the walk. And then there's a conversation that's just starting about maybe having a day when we encourage people to do events in support. I mean, I have said, oh, you know, you could organize a walk back where you act at home, you know. But I think we will put out a day somewhere in July and say, you know, if you can on this day, why don't you have a something, you know, a walk, a sit, an educational event, whatever you feel like.
And on the website, people can find out where you are. So if people actually want to come and walk with you for a day or a weekend, people can do that, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's that will usually involve cars. Because we're going, it's really boondocks. We'll be prepared to pick people up from you know, bus stations and stuff like that. Oh yeah, if somebody wants to get rid of a car for 3 months. But actually, we're too far away. It should be somebody closer so that it would be easy to get it and easy to, because I would have to drive it a long way.
Do you want other organizations like 350 to know about so they can tell other people?
Yeah, and we have some communication with them, but there are zillions of organizations and we have not come close to touching. So any organizations that you know, send them an email or give them a call.
And no one from Tassa Harris go with you?
I think that's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was one person who said he would. Now, Naomi is doing our web stuff now. Naomi Yoder. But there was a young man named Key who thought I would be able to find his Facebook page. You know how many people there are with his name? And then there was the woman who decided to be a guest cook. So...
Well, we can have, maybe we'll close now formally because Shoto has to catch a bus into her next part of her itinerary. So we'll close formally now.
Mm-hmm.